It's time for three stories you should know. Former San Francisco 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick and Nike are back in the news, and that's where we're going to start this week. I'm joined by Amira Rose Davis, Penn State professor and co-host of the Burn It All Down podcast, and by WBUR's Callum Borchers. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks.
Great to be here, Karen.
Callum, it's your turn.
American flags are everywhere this week as we celebrate Independence Day and also beating England again 2.5 centuries later in the World Cup. But it's an early version of the flag that caught my attention this week. I'm talking about the Betsy Ross flag. That's the one from the Revolutionary War era with 13 stars in a circle to represent the original colonies. Nike had planned to put the Betsy Ross flag on the heel of a special edition shoe for the 4th of July, but then decided not to sell the shoe after all, reportedly because Colin Kaepernick told the company that the old banner recalls a time of slavery and has been appropriated by some white supremacists. And Kaepernick, of course, is one of Nike's most prominent endorsers, even though the quarterback has been in NFL exile since leading bended knee protests of racial injustice during national anthems. So Nike's decision to pull the shoe has received mixed reviews. No surprise. And the leading critic is Arizona's governor, Doug Ducey, who withdrew $1 million incentive for the company to open a plant in his state. So Karen and Amira Rose, did Nike make the right call here?
Yeah, I mean, completely they did. And you don't have to look very far to see how this flag has been reappropriated by white nationalist groups. But beyond that, you know, the history beyond the lore of Betsy Ross, you know, lends itself to be kind of further scrutinized. And I think that Colin did exactly what he should do in that position. But I just found it funny that all these people, Senator Ted Cruz, for instance, were like, aha, I'm burning my Nike shoes and boycotting. And I was like, didn't you guys do that last year?
Right.
Like, I thought you already had a boycott in effect. You know, I think that you see that people are more upset about the pulling of this shoe than, say, like kids in cages at the border. And so I just have no patience or time for their, you know, Fox outrage.
Yeah, I mean, the fact is that we're in a bit of a moment right now where we're coming to grips with the fact that our past is not as simple as our fifth grade teachers taught us it was. And in that environment, it just doesn't make any sense at all to me to put a 240-year-old flag on a shoe. I mean, Nike had a much better option if it wanted to be patriotic. And I've said this before, but I feel like at this point, Nike is seeking out controversy because controversy sells. Mm. You know, Nike made Colin Kaepernick the face of its Just Do It campaign in September, and not at all coincidentally, the brand's sales have jumped 7% this year. Nike stock is up 12%. And Nike created this controversy, and I worry now that they're going to find some way to take advantage of it and profit off the divisiveness in this country again.
Yeah, it took a while to get to this decision, right? Even if it was the right one in the end. And so I think that there's kind of a business lesson here about the value of diversity in your workplace. Mm-hmm. We don't know all the people who were involved in conceiving and approving this original plan to use the Betsy Ross flag, but we do know that their shoes got all the way through production and were even shipped to retailers before being yanked at the last minute. It took this intervention by Colin Kaepernick at the end to get Nike to change course. So it appears that the perspective of someone who might have said earlier on, hey, this symbol is painful for some people, was missing throughout the creative process earlier on.
All right, Amira Rose, you're up.
Yeah, so this week, the National Women's Soccer League and ESPN announced an agreement. So the network will televise 14 games during the remainder of the season. If you remember, the NWSL season started about a month and a half ago, and they had Lifetime and A&E Network pull out of their prearranged agreement a year early. Lifetime had been broadcasting the game in this like attempt to say, women watch Lifetime and women's soccer should be on Lifetime. It was a mess anyways. But they started the season with no televised rights, only having streaming rights for their games. And so now ESPN has reached this deal. It includes 11 regular season games plus 3 postseason games. And so on one hand, yes, I'm really excited that they will have more visibility, that they are finally in this television deal. But there's part of me, I'm not going to lie, that's like, okay, this is a day late and a dollar too short. Most of these games, 8 out of those 11 regular season games, are going to be showing on ESPN News, which Which is like, okay, great, but literally I watched a hot dog eating contest in cornhole on ESPN2 on Thursday.
Did you have Joey Chestnut or Kobayashi?
Chestnut, yes, exactly. Also feels like this kind of reactive thing where everybody's like, oh my goodness, the women's national team is good and we should invest, et cetera, et cetera. And it's like, well, we've known this. I think this deal leaves me feeling kind of ambivalent about the future of the NWSL still.
Yeah, well, to your point, I mean, capitalizing on Americans' love of the national team is the longstanding challenge for women's soccer. Yeah. We had the frenzy around Brandi Chastain and the 1999 mm-hmm. World Cup win. That helped create the Women's United Soccer Association. And that league didn't even make it until the next World Cup before folding. There was another pro league that came yeah. and went in between. But this NWSL, it's in its seventh season. So that's the longest run for any of these leagues so far. And I think, Amira Rose, you're right. They finally got the right platform here in ESPN. Being on Lifetime never really made a whole lot of sense
at all.
And I think the other thing I'm mindful of, too, is, you know, there's more to media coverage than just the games themselves, but those two things are related. What I mean is the network is more likely to cover games if they also have the broadcast rights to those games. We've seen this with women's tennis, for example, right? I mean, ESPN covers women's tennis a lot more now that it has Wimbledon broadcast rights than it used to when the matches were on NBC. So I think we're more likely to see NWSL highlights on SportsCenter. We're more likely to read about the games on ESPN.com now that ESPN wants to promote its telecasts of those games.
Yeah, I think this thing where women's soccer blows up for every World Cup and then the leagues fold in between. I feel like this is very similar to the problem that many Olympic sports have. Like, everyone loves figure skating and gymnastics during the Olympics, but how many of us actually tune in during the off years? As Callum said, women's soccer has tried repeatedly to capitalize off their World Cup popularity, and there are a couple of failed women's soccer leagues to prove it. What is it going to take, Amira Rose, to turn women's soccer from an every 4 years sport into an all-the-time sport?
Yeah, certainly. I think you pointed to some of the issue here where it's when it's a nationalistic endeavor, right? The Olympics, the World Cup, it's really easy to get behind women's sports. And so sustaining it in the interim means, A, planning before you're in the middle of the World Cup to capitalize on it. So social media plans, hiring people in this position that can really market this league. And right now it feels like the infrastructure at place in the NWSL is a little out of touch. But I think beyond this, you know, Callum brings up a really great point about ESPN and their platform. Mm-hmm. So that's a really great first step. But beyond that, it's about coverage outside of just that. Famously, right, when the Breakers left Boston, there was a whole article about it in the Globe, and it's like they didn't cover the Breakers when they were playing. They only covered their collapse. So, you know, getting ahead of it and really looking forward to finding those stories that people glob onto, I think is a good way to go. You have 55 women across multiple national teams who competed in France who played domestically in the NWSL. This is a great time to, I think, try to sustain it and just see past. You know, you have the Olympics next year, so you can kind of double down and hopefully that has some longevity in it.
Major League Baseball held its first regular season series in London last week, and let's start with the good. The games virtually sold out a stadium that seats 60,000 people. Royalty showed up, though there was some concern that Harry might not have been paying enough attention to Meghan. And hearing the games called by broadcasters with English accents was just spectacular.
And what a first inning in London. We are off and running. We've had 12 runs. It's the Yankees 6. It's the Red Sox 6.
And that's where we get to the bad. 12 runs in the first inning. Pitching change after pitching change after pitching change. That first game lasted 4 hours and 42 minutes. The second felt downright quick at just 4 hours and 24 minutes. The teams combined for 50 runs over two games. And still, one British newspaper found some dude in the stands watching cricket on his phone because baseball just wasn't exciting enough. Can we really even say at this point that the Brits saw real baseball, Amira Rose?
Well, I mean, certainly they saw the Red Sox and the Yankees, whose games are notoriously long. But so on that end, that was very accurate. But it was a mess. It was a mess in general. But I think that at the same time, runs are exciting. So in that sense, you know, give a damn about pitching. You know, the efforts to bring the game, we've seen this with football as well. I find it awkward every time they try to do it.
You know, I'd call it baseball on steroids, except that we've seen baseball on steroids. And even that wasn't as ludicrous as what we saw in London. You know, as we heard on that brilliant British call, you know, there were 12 runs in the very first inning across the pond. That hadn't happened in 30 years. That was the combined total of runs in that first game. So it just got out of hand. Not at all representative of what baseball normally looks like. But that might be a good thing, Karen. It might be the best thing for growing the game in Europe. I'm reminded of the reverse scenario that we had here in Boston 9 years ago when Fenway Park hosted a soccer match between Glasgow Celtic and Sporting Lisbon. It was one of those grow the game in America type of things, right? But there were zero goals until the 72nd minute. It was 1-1 at the end of regulation. In other words, it was very representative of what soccer looks like, and I don't think it converted very many soccer skeptics. So I'm thinking that accurate representation is overrated. If the Brits now think that baseball is more exciting than it actually is, that's probably good for the sport.
Yeah, but the next time they show up for a game or tune in for a game, they're going to be like, what?
They'll be disappointed,
this?
Right?
Can you imagine if it's a pitcher's duel? I find that boring. I can't imagine what, after watching these two games of 50 runs, what would go down. My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been Amira Rose Davis, Penn State professor and co-host of the Burn It All Down podcast, and WBUR's Callum Borchers. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you for having me.
It's been fun. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Only a Game from NPR.